Health Sciences Education rounds this morning. And if I had known that moving it to 7:30 was going to bring everybody in, I would have done that earlier. So I want to welcome you, but a couple of faces perhaps that are new. My name is Elaine Van Mel, and I'm the director of the Office of Health Sciences Education here at Queen's in the Faculty of Health Sciences. And that's an office that supports curricular design and educational scholarship for the Faculty of Health Sciences. And so needless to say, when we heard that there was a dean coming who had such an incredible background in education, we were thrilled. And so the fact that Dr. Resnick is just back from Sweden, where he won and was awarded the prestigious Karolinska Institute Prize in Medical Education, I think really speaks to his accomplishments. I think as well the fact that he has over 120 peer-reviewed publications in medical education and also has done over 200 presentations in the field also speaks to his incredible body of work. And in fact, as I read through Dr. Resnick's CV, what really struck me was how all of the topics that he's looked at in medical education have really been the topic of the day. And there's no question that today's session on competency-based education is right in there. In fact, there are very few conferences or sessions that you can go to these days that don't talk about competency-based education. And so the intriguing title of Dr. Resnick's talk today is Competency-Based Education. It's about radical curricular change. And so please join me in welcoming Dr. Resnick.
Thank you, Elaine. I think I'm a little more nervous in talking to members of our own faculty than other faculties, but thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to give these rounds, and thank you for inviting me. With apologies to those whose educational efforts focus more on undergraduate education, this talk focuses mostly on resident education, and there's a slant just for Dr. McCann's to talk about surgical resident education. So we'll bear our soul to you, and you can reaffirm how bad we are in surgery. But I think hopefully some of the principles will be extrapolatable to areas in which you all work. The first thing I'd like to do is say that this is not my work. Of course, I've been involved, but this is the work of many, and I've had the good privilege of having about 30 graduate students over the years, many of them have been central to building the concepts in this work. So let me start by telling you a story, and this is a story about six young residents, and indeed it's a very, very short story. And I could kind of just end here, and we'd all have some coffee and donuts, and that'd be that. But the story about these six residents has a very long prologue. So I'd like to spend some time talking about the prologue and end up a little bit completing the story. And the prologue is that this whole issue, many of issues that are coalescing today, actually started 30 or 40 years ago, and they haven't really just come to fore today. They started when, does that work here? Is this the pointer? I want to just use a pointer. If this is a pointer? Okay. Anyhow, they started when, there you go. You got to put it in, right? Thanks. Plug and play. Thank you so much. They started when Charles Bosch rummaged around the Chicago hospital about 30 years ago, only to find the incredible use and abuse of residents, which he reported in a sociologic fashion. They started when William Nolan wrote what it was like to be a surgical resident in Bellevue in New York about 25 years ago, and his 120 hours a week that he worked. They were intersected by too many babies dying in Bristol because of bad cardiac surgery. And of course, fortified by the IOM report, which you all know, where it was purported that we could save hundreds of thousands of lives if we kept our eye focused on the patient safety ball. And they perhaps were catapulted to conscious vision by the infamous Libby Zion case, a case of a young woman who was purported to have died in the emergency department at the hands of fatigued intern. Turned out that that was probably a terrible case. It wasn't, you know, there were many complexities to that case, but nonetheless, it rocked the state, changed legislation, rocked the nation, and had reverberations around the world. Part of our issues are that training's too long. You are all taking into your professional programs the very best and the very brightest individuals. And in terms of medical education, what we then do after 4 years, often coming after a graduate degree, we put them through 4 years of medical school, 4 to 5 years of residency, 2 to 5 years, 2 to 3 years of fellowship. Almost everybody does a fellowship now. And then if they want to be an academic clinician, that's another 2 to 5 years of academic training. Well, that's a long time. That's a lot of training. And it's exacerbated by the fact that training hours are radically changing around the world. And if you look at this this little graph, it shows you where we are pegged in Canada, roughly at the higher end of the spectrum, about 70 hours a week for most surgical residents, that is Dr. McCann's. I know medical residents only work about 8 hours a week. But... I pick on you the whole day. But let there be no mistake that within a decade we will be here. We will be where Europe is, in the 40-50 hour a week range for residency training. And it won't be so much an issue of sleep deprivation or an issue of changing times. What it'll be is an HR issue. It'll be legislated by government, and it won't just be applied to residents, it'll apply to professional staff as well. That's what's happened in France. It's kind of happening now in Holland, and we'll quickly follow probably within a decade or so. So how are we going to train all that we need to do in what's become almost a third of the amount of time that many of us in this room spent in the hospitals when we were training? So we kind of took this on and said, okay, well, does it really make a difference? And one of the recent studies we did, and when I say we, this is my colleagues before I came to Queen's in Toronto. So, and these were colleagues both in, Marlise is from Utrecht, she's now moved to Amsterdam, a group from Holland and a group from Toronto. We compared Dutch and Canadian residents head on head. These were ready for practice residents, so we had already passed them on to their exams and said they could practice as far as we were concerned. And we looked at their cognitive knowledge, their judgment, and their technical skills. And what we found was from a technical point of view, they were kind of equivalent. What we found from a cognitive point of view, there was no difference. From a complex medical judgment, the Canadians fared better. But that's not the whole story. The story carries on because it's kind of confounded by the fact that that Canadian examiners like Canadians, and Dutch examiners like Dutch. So there was a systematic bias in the intersection between examiner and student that we hadn't thought of. At least we looked for, but we hadn't expected. So it really is for future studies, and these will have to be replicated. It tells us that we have to be aware of a cultural bias in any scoring scheme that traverses different kinds of educational programs. This data, which was published a year ago, is kind of scary. Basically, they asked Nick Bell from the American Board of Surgeons asked program directors, please categorize general surgical operations, A, B, and C. A were that you got to know, if you're going to be out there, you really got to know this operation. B were that it'd be good to know, but maybe you could refer that patient, maybe it's not so critical. And C, probably no point in incorporating that into a regular stream residency because it'll be unlikely used. So this just refers to A, or must-know operations. It was only in 18 of 121 must-know operations that Dr. Bell found that American residents had more than 10 experiences. In 83 of 121, they had less than 5. And in 31 of must-know procedures, they had done less than 1 in their training. And the modal value for 63 of these was 0. So a real wake-up call in terms of what American residents are graduating. And we need to extrapolate that Canadians are probably not much different. And this whole issue, to me, is exacerbated by the issue of psychological transfer. So that means, if you can take out a right colon, can you take out a left? Well, the reality is probably not. Okay, psychological transfer we've been relying on for many, many years. Sarah, how often have you told your residents, I'll teach you the principles of this, and then when you face novel situations, you'll be able to incorporate them. Well, the leading scholar on psychological transfer, Detterman, tells us that educators must assume that transfer is as rare as a volcanic eruption, and that we should be functioning as if it doesn't really exist. Okay, so expertise is not a matter of transferring and importing principles from one area to another. It's a matter of being there over and over and over again in the precise same or almost precise same location. And that's what will define expertise. So experience does count. I learned this in the last little while watching my ridiculous son play rugby for McGill. I don't understand this stupid game. I don't know, are there any New Zealanders in the crowd, or Aussies, or Brits, or South Africans? Yeah, so Jenny, you know maybe a little bit about this stupid game, but I don't. But I am a good dad. So what I've done is I've counted all the passes he's made. And I've counted the passes he's made in the backyard with his brother and with his friends. And I looked at the 6 practices a week and calculated that he has 4,000 passes on the pitch when he trains with his team. But look how many passes he makes in the game. Very few. Our residents in surgery right now are only making passes in the game, where it counts. Okay? They're not getting a chance, by and large, for systematic, effective, deliberate practice. And this slide of the world's most famous motor psychologist of our time, Anders Ericsson, Anders Ericsson tells us that the difference between expert performers and normal adults is a lifelong period of practice in a deliberate effort to improve your performance. A lifetime period. So our residents are not getting those opportunities because we haven't built it into their curriculum. So kind of, this is kind of where we're at. You know, the unionistic 8 hours is enough, thank you very much, with an hour and a half for lunch and 3 coffee breaks, versus Malcolm Gladwell telling us that you need 10,000 hours of distinct practice to be able to flourish and become an expert. So we think we have the answer. So everybody's been pondering and head-scratching and all this stuff, and they say, okay, well, we got the answer. The answer is competency-based education. Let's turn it all around. Let's change the paradigm. Let's focus on the competencies. Well, so let's really look at what that means. So for some people, that's the solution to all problems in postgraduate medical education. There's another body of thought that it's the genesis of the problems, of all problems in PGME. For some people, it just means the competencies. You know, you've got to think beyond the medical expert role or the technical. It means this breadth of what it means to be a complete doctor. For some people, it means that why should we look at time spent on task? Why shouldn't we look at performance as the ultimate decision maker about who's ready and who's not? For some people, and for most residencies, I would argue, it's resulted in a minor tweaking of a curriculum. And what I'm going to suggest and posit is that because of all these events, because we're living in a special time of all of these events coalescing, we can't afford to tweak. What we need is curricular change, and we probably need radical curricular change. In surgery, we're working on a Halstedian model that's about 130 years old. Halsted's long since dead, and the system's no longer durable. Competency-based education is not new. It's not new at all. The first throes of competency-based education trace back to the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh 500 years ago, when they said, no matter of person shall employ our said crafts unless he or she be worthy and expert in all subjects belonging to said crafts and be diligently and advisedly examined. The roots of competency-based training. Deb Danoff and Jason Frank said, so think about it from the end point of view, and then work backwards and design your curriculum. What are these competencies? What's going to be this phenotype of this fantastic obstetrician gynecologist, and then work backwards and design the curriculum? And of course, we've done so in the concept of all these frameworks. We have nice fancy frameworks like CAMMED's frameworks, like the ACGME competencies, the Good Scottish Doctor. There's a whole bunch of them, right? They all kind of say the same thing. You can't just focus on knowledge. You have to think more broadly. But there's been a move in the last 2 or 3 years to be highly critical of competency-based education as the sole solution for all of our problems. Swing said, competency-based education has been criticized for being reductionistic and focusing only on atomistic skills, failing to capture the essence of what it means to be a true professional. Echoed by Barnett, who said, understanding, I've been urging, is an active form of engagement. It's a form of agency. It's a form of self-expression. And it kind of strikes against the conventionalism of competence, insofar as competency is the fulfillment of predetermined standards. And finally, Talbot said, when tasks are broken down into their subunits, the assessee is graded according to successful serial completion. Such a competency construct is a learning paradigm. It's not the same as competence. Competence is a step on the road to professional excellence. And part of the problem with competency-based education is it's kind of predicated on Joe. All right? So here's Joe. Meet Joe. You know Joe. Joe is the guy, you get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning, your wife or husband or partner hands you the phone and says, it's Joe on the phone. And you say, oh my goodness, it's Joe. You know it's going to be a long conversation. It's going to be 2 or 3 hours of torture extricating facts from Joe. He starts talking in a garbled way, and it's about this, and it's about that, and you can't figure out whether the patient's bleeding or has diarrhea or what. But you know, sort of gradually facts emerge. And with prompting and with help, Joe comes up with the right strategy. And 3 hours later, you try to go back to sleep, you're exasperated as heck, and you end up going to the hospital anyhow to check Joe out. All right? Joe is this marginally competent, barely acceptable, bare pass, but a pass. Okay? So all of our cut scores in medical education are predicated on Joe. That's how we define a pass. But the trouble is, you don't want to meet Joe when you go to the emergency department, and you don't want your mother to meet Joe when she goes to the emergency department, and nobody wants to work with Joe. But he's a pass. All of these, Hosty, Angoff, Nadelsky, these are all different ways of setting a passing score. They're all predicated on the marginally competent, barely acceptable resident. So it kind of begs the point, what are we trying to do here? What bar are we trying to set? Are we trying to set a minimalistic bar of competence, or are we trying to take deliberate action to continuously raise the bar? And this is supposed to work here. Maybe. It doesn't matter. There's a nice little piece of music of a violin. But anyhow, it really begs the point, is are we striving for competence or are we striving for virtuosity? And because when you go to the opera tonight, you're not interested in the soprano who's off key. I mean, you'll be really upset if she's off key. Right? So where's our bar and where are we setting it? So I would argue that we're at a precipice. And that we have to challenge ourselves to fundamentally think differently from the way we've thought. And that's what we've kind of done with this short story I'm about to tell you about these six residents. I told you I had a long prologue. So basically, in a nutshell, this is the story. The story is that this is how we train right now. We create this totally potential generalist, I hate that word, everybody's going to beat up on me, that's okay, a generalist beast, okay, who's everything to mankind or womankind, and then gradually, slowly, inexorably, over 15 years, we enter into a zone of confidence of a zone of practice. All right? That's what we do. Dr. McCanns cannot put in sutures anymore, I bet.
But he probably
put a lot of sutures in. Dr. Reed, when's the last time you read an electrocardiogram?
Just my own, Richard.
Yeah. Okay. So, what if we turn that triangle upside down and said, you know, we're accepting. I just had 15 students over to the house last night, and these kids are the best and the brightest people that you've ever met, right? Why can't they become fantastic at their zone of confidence early on, within a year or two or three, and continue to grow and learn the rest of their competencies with time? Unlike what we're doing now, and it's only when their fellowship years that they're really getting to be able to do things that are that are material to their job. So we developed a six-point plan. Lindsay will be very happy to hear that we did this in orthopedics. That's because orthopods are so terrific and such great educators. And it actually is true. We had tremendous benefit of a fantastic orthopedic team that dedicated themselves to this. So the first thing is tackling the politics. The second thing is achieving the competencies through modular-based training. So these residents are no longer assigned to Dr. Davidson's service. They're assigned to a series of objectives that exist in a module. Dramatically accelerate the pace of technical skill acquisition. Get rid of all the CRAP in residency. Incorporate meaningful assessment on a day-to-day basis. And finally, understand that we're living in a different world where we have to function in teams, and we're not going to be able to function in the hierarchical model of yesteryear. So we went to the government and we said, we got a way of making orthopedic surgeons differently. And they said, can that be faster? And we said, yeah, sure could. Might be slower. We didn't say that. but it's different. And so that was it. They gave us $1.7 million to kickstart this program, which was a real help to enable this. Not to trivialize the financial issue, this will have additional costs. But if you think about what we spend on our GNP for healthcare, what's about 14-15% in Canada now, what we spend on healthcare education is but a very minute fraction. And we need to redress that imbalance. As I say, the residents are assigned not to a service, but to an objective. So they have their own secretary who scouts around town and different areas for experiences that are objective-specific, appropriate for that particular module, and that's where they go. And I want to make the point that this is not just about the technical. Okay, even though this is in surgery, this is not just purely technical. And every module is infused with a breadth of competencies that relate to the important other CanMeds competencies. And it's kind of, they finish when they finish, right? So if it takes them 6 months to do a module, that's fine. If it takes them a month to do a module, that's also fine. They're pre-tested, they have the education, they're post-tested, and when they reach a certain benchmark, then they can go on. So it's not time-based, but it's competency-based. They actually finished, there's 21 modules, for the whole orthopedic curriculum, and in their first year they finished 6. So they're tracking on a very accelerated pace, compared to the conventional resident.
Catherine, I know you're here today for some results of your recent surgery, but I need to pause for a minute and tell you that I'm not going to be able to give you those results today. And the reason is that we've had a major problem. I'm going to spend the next few minutes telling you about this problem, telling you about what happened, telling you I'm desperately sorry that we've had this problem, and also telling you what I think we should do to go forward. But the short of it is, Catherine, we operated on the wrong breast.
Why?
So, the point of putting this teaching video here is that this is not about turning professional training into vocational training. This is about teaching the professional. And in surgery, I must admit, we have a long way to go. We did this study to find that when faced with an error, roughly over half of surgeons used the word mistake. Only two-thirds took responsibility for their error. Less than half offered an apology, told the patient they were sorry. And very few said, how are we going to not let this happen again? So we have a lot of work to do in some of these non-expert competencies. This is probably the most important element of the 6 points, and that's the issue of who and when can who should be doing operations and when. All right. And the reality is that right now, in most technical specialties, it's not until your fifth year or your fellowship year that you're really starting to operate. Okay, that you're really becoming skilled. And I would argue that there's no reason. Who fights F-16? Who flies F-16 fighter pilots? How old are they? They're 23 and 24. They're protecting our country. They're flying over Afghanistan. It's equally as complex as taking out an ovary, I can assure you. Right? Why is it that we have our residents hanging around the wards, filling out home care papers for their first three years of their residency? It doesn't make any sense. And one of the reasons it doesn't make any sense is because of this graph. And this graph shows us that, or reminds us, that this is a graph of human cognitive function, that we start to decline right about there. So just when we're graduating our residents, they're on a decline. And there's similar curves for technical performance and other performance of human function. Okay? So that's scary, right? And indeed, if you think about it, who are they? You know, a phenomenal athlete is finishing his career at age 35 or 40, right? Highly technically oriented specialties often start to. Now we compensate, you know, through experience and through tricks and a whole variety of different mechanisms. And indeed, some people are competent into their 90s. But this graph, we need to keep pace. So one of the answers here about ramping up the technical speed acquisition is not just relying on the passes in the game, but relying on passes in the laboratory. Okay? And taking some of the teaching outside the regular stream and putting it in a technical skills laboratory. Right? And we had the good fortune in Toronto of having one for about 13 years now, and we really ramped up the laboratory experience for these competency-based residents. So they spent their whole first 3 months in the lab. So by the time they got out, they were so familiar with the drills and with the plating and with casting that they could do with their eyes closed. And when they got to Dr. Davidson's operating room, she didn't have to start from ground zero and say, okay, here's how you tie a knot. You know, all of those sort of obligate competencies were mastered, long since mastered. Simulation is going to be a very big part of our world in many different vistas. This next story is going to pale a little bit because I can't locate the video that I want to show you. But anyhow, suffice it to say, this is a story about a colleague of mine, Alan O'Cranick. And Alan wanted to teach laparoscopic surgery to individuals in Botswana. And there was a program that's a kind of a package program called FLS. And he took this to Botswana. He trained 12 surgeons, gave them a pre-test, post-test. Only two passed. He came back on the on the plane, quite upset. What had he done? He hadn't succeeded at all. And then he thought of a different mechanism of dealing with this. So there is the surgeon in Botswana. This is Alan in Toronto. There are two computers. This fellow has two computers and a laparoscopic box. And this is communicating by Skype. Very inexpensive. And a method of teaching. He went on a longitudinal program of teaching these skills to these surgeons in Botswana, and they all passed. They all passed. He now has a program where he's doing this teaching in China, in Chile, in Argentina, in Hungary, literally all over the world, fueled by a fair whack of funding that he's managed to achieve. This study, done by Tidar Grantcharov, who we had the good fortune to recruit from Denmark, looked at randomizing students, putting half of them in a simulator, half of them learning through observation and videos, bringing them into the operating room, letting them do parts of a cholecystectomy, videotaping that cholecystectomy, sending it to blinded reviewers, and just for ease of and quickness of presentation, less errors, better economy of motion, and faster with the use of a simulator. And simulators are getting better. This study that was done, again by Alan O'Kranick, looked at the old generation of simulators where, you know, you picked up little pieces of rubber and tubing and it didn't look like an operation at all, but it was enabling your laparoscopic skills, versus the new generation, which actually looks like you're taking out a gallbladder. And he randomized residents into these two groups, experience with this simulator and experience with that simulator. And then he did intraoperative recording of videos, again, send them to blinded reviewers, and he used Jerry Fried's from Montreal metric of laparoscopic assessment. And you don't need to be too much of a statistician to find out that the second generation of simulators are serving us way better now than the first generation. And we're just in the embryonic phases. We're just starting with this whole field of simulation.
There's very little doctors can do with the late stages of Kennedy's brain cancer, but a new surgical development out of Halifax promises to make future brain surgery safer. Ross Lord shows us now inside a virtual operating room.
Think of it as a video game for brain surgeons, a simulator that's made history in Halifax.
For the first time worldwide, we have satisfied the basic criteria of virtual reality brain surgery.
Before the surgery, doctors conducted a full rehearsal in vivid detail using MRI scans to accurately map the patient's brain.
As I start, I feel the tip of the instrument touching the tumor. I can feel it vibrating and actually a tumor starting to be removed.
Taking special care not to intrude on these blue spots, parts of the brain that control speech. Ellen Wright says she feels fine, finally rid of the tumor and 3 years of migraines and dizzy spells.
I'm glad that they could do this before me, because like you said, that's got a reset button. I don't.
She said, for those who didn't hear, she's glad that there's this technology, because she said the machine has a reset button and I don't. So this is going to happen. This is 5-10 years away on a regular basis for complex operations. Surgeons, nurses, anesthetists, the entire team are going to get together in the operating room the night before, downloading patients' real data of their problem, and rehearsing, and then doing the operation. This is the future of surgery. The next element for these residents was to diminish wasted time. So yes, there's value in filling out a home care form, or in chasing down an X-ray, or putting in an order for a hemoglobin, but it's very limited. And are there any residents in the crowd? What year are you in, sir?
Third.
How many home care forms have you filled out?
You can't count them.
Right? How much educational value after the first couple? A rhetorical question, right? But the reality is, you probably spent a fair bit of your day, I'm not sure what discipline you're on, but not doing stuff that's really hardcore to your education, and that can't be done by others that are not on a goal of becoming a medical specialist, right? Would you agree with that? Maybe. Okay, we'll choose the debate. So we want to diminish wasted time, but also in so doing, seriously address the issue of sleep deprivation. You know, the literature on sleep deprivation is mixed. About half the articles say it's a problem, half the articles have shown evidence of no decrement in performance. But the reality is that there's new and emerging evidence that on enough dimensions, serious sleep deprivation needs to be contended with. The thing that drove Dr. Flynn to the beauty parlor for get rid of a few gray hairs over and over again, if I may say that, secrets out, was the issue of when she looked after 33 residents, she was not happy with all 33 modes of assessment, that they weren't rigorously evaluating their residents. Even though we have a very robust toolbox to assess residents, the problem is, often, as evidenced in this next video, the toolbox is closed.
During residency, pretty much always you can call apart from that point.
Well, evidence became strong enough 3 years ago. I know bowel cramps become part of our fast track routine. Any good news?
Well, you are still flying out tomorrow, but they had to move your flight from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Dr. Friedbeck was looking for you.
Oh, tell him I moved to Arizona. I'll call. What's next?
They need you to sign those. Mr. Walton is in exam room 2, and Jenny from the division called. They said they haven't gotten your either for Stephen.
Caldwell. Can you go start with Mr. Walton? Hey, Caldwell was the tallish guy, right? And he was here for 8 weeks?
3 months.
Okay, but you liked him, right?
Yeah, he was okay in the
arm. I'll be right there. Can you get Robin Richards on the phone for me, uncle?
Unless you need anything else, sir, boy.
Good night. Hi. Yeah. No, almost on the way. Okay. No. No, just take care of it. Oh, yeah, yeah, no.
I know that never happens on any of your shows, right, Leslie? That you never say anything like that. Really, we've got to do a better job of frequent assessment on an ongoing basis if we're going to assure competence. This was our first small step in technical surgery, where we kind of invented an exam about 12, 13 years ago. This is a mock-up of a tracheostomy, and we brought them to the lab, had them do a tracheostomy, and within about 10 or 15 minutes, you really get a handle on whether someone can or can't do a tracheostomy. That's a mock-up of a femoral embolectomy, and the artery and vein have the same biomechanical properties as the human artery and vein. And we then spent the next 9 years, sounds like a pretty boring life, and it was, basically doing the grunt work of creating a new exam. And that's making sure that there's inter-rater reliability, interstation reliability, construct validity, concurrent validity, that it's not just parochial to one location, that it's feasible, and that we can meet this out to other jurisdictions. And now it's being used in England, in Australia, and the United States, and of course in Ontario. And where it's come to really help us is this. In Ontario, you may know there's a program where surgeons who are practicing surgeons in other countries can come and try to access a license to practice here. And in the past, they have to pass a series of cognitive exams, but in the past, they had to pass no technical exams. We introduced this to the college, and this is fake data, but it's from a real file, This guy trained in Greece, then worked in the community, passed all his exams, had great letters of reference, blah, blah, blah. But because we've been doing this OSATS exam for so long, we know what a PGY1 should look like, and that's in red. PGY2 in yellow, green. And this was Dr. Athenos, candidate one. So not so quickly was he going to operate on the Ontario public. And we offered him a spot as a first-year resident. And 5 years later, he graduated. And finally, we're trying to imbue in these six residents, as with all our residents, that we're in a sea change of the way we practice. And that we're not practicing in this hierarchical model anymore. And probably the best evidence I have of that is the culture change that took place, as evidenced by this video clip, for this last experiment that I'm going to show you.
Does anybody know when he's coming? How about a rough estimate? More than a minute, less than a hockey season. More than an hour, less than the lifespan of a giant redwood tree.
Carter.
Hungry, thirsty, and tired. I'm cold, my arm just fell asleep.
Stop being a baby.
Plus, I feel like I'm hanging out of this thing. Could someone cover up my crotch, please?
He's here.
We have a visitor. I don't remember being asked if Dr. Benton could scrub in for this.
I'm a friend of the patient. He asked if I would observe.
Uh-huh. Put him under. Let's do this.
Whoa, whoa. What about the checklist?
Excuse me?
Safe surgery checklist?
I've had 10 cases the day after.
All the more reason to take the necessary precautions. It only took a minute.
1 minute.
John Cotter here for a right cadaveric renal allograft.
Does the patient have a known allergy?
No.
Does anesthesia anticipate a difficult airway?
No.
Is the risk of bleeding greater than 500 cc's?
I sure as hell hope not. Let's go put him under.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Everybody slow down. Now let's just take our time and introduce them.
What's next? We all hold hands and sing Kumbaya?
Sheila Lane, scrub nurse.
Paula Cheney, circulating nurse.
Kay Schumacher, anesthesiologist.
Randall Okerman, chief surgical resident.
Ethan Dean, surgical intern.
Peter Benton, observing general surgeon. Any concerns from the surgical team?
Although then you're wasting my time.
Any nursing concerns?
We don't have any reperfusion solution.
We won't be needing it.
I'll have some set up.
Were any antibiotics given in the last 60 minutes?
Just starting them now.
Ben Blake.
Hold on. If you run the antibiotics prior to incision, you cut the risk of infection by half.
Dr. Benton, you're a guest here, and I don't like guests. As a friend of the patient, you're welcome to sit, observe, and shut up.
Template. Anastomosis are complete. Releasing the clamp.
Suture lines look good, now leash.
Have a PDF for the ureter. Shouldn't it be picking up by now?
What happened to sitting quietly in the corner, Dr. Benton?
No, seriously, shouldn't it be?
Aha. Find another power source. Do we have a power source? I guess we do. Yeah. We'll just take a second. There you go. Just at a moment's notice. Problem solved.
Does anybody know when he's coming?
Uh-oh.
How about a rough estimate?
I don't know how
a minute, less
that.
Than a hockey stick. More than an hour, less than the lifespan of a giant redwood tree.
Carter.
Hungry. Thirsty. Tired.
Cold.
Arm.
Yeah, but I wanted to show you the end. But anyway, it doesn't matter. So the end, of course, of this...
Show us the end.
What? You do? Well, there may be a way here. Hang on for a sec. Where is... just give me a sec, all right? Where is my computer? And then removal of the disk. And then that... And then ER, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. You're good. Does anybody know when he's coming? I'm a guest here, and I don't
want. Perfect.
Guest here.
Oh, seriously, shouldn't it be?
Okay.
Sometimes it takes a minute.
I don't have parenchymal pulse.
We've got an arterial thrombosis. Reclaim and take out the suture.
Satinsky, please.
Where's the clock?
Renal artery is obstructing the blood flow. Gonna have to take it out and start all over again.
Problem solved. Plus with heparin saline and reperfusion solution.
Reperfusion solution?
We've got it. We're all set.
Oh, well, it's a good thing we just have some lying around, huh? How long did it take to get the reperfusion solution up from the pharmacy?
15 minutes.
What happens if you don't have the reperfusion solution?
You made your point, Doctor?
No, I disagree, Doctor. I think that this is an excellent teaching opportunity, you know. You'd have 15 minutes of warm ischemia, the organ would have taken a major blow, and there's a good chance we would have ended up with a non-functioning kidney. Wouldn't you agree, Doctor?
If we're all done teaching here, perhaps some of you would like to assist me in getting this kidney back into the patient's body.
Where do you get a copy of that checklist?
No, people!
Do this now and go back to the.
But that was slide 61.
There. This 3-minute checklist that I have the great pleasure of working on with the WHO can really make a difference. We tested this in 8 cities across the world. 4 nations that are developed and 4 nations that have financial challenges. And we were quite surprised to find a significant reduction in morbidity and mortality in the checklist group. A 3-minute checklist saved lives. Don Berwick from the IHI said he's never seen anything like it. He's been working in the field for 30 years. Ladies and gentlemen, if we want to avoid everybody's favorite sport, that's including Dr. McCann's, and that's bashing up on surgeons, then we really need to do something different. And thanks to the good work of at least 20 orthopods, but led by a team of our chair of orthopedic surgery in Toronto, Ben Ullman, Peter Ferguson, the competency-based program director, and Bill Kramer, the program director, about 14 months ago, we accepted 3 residents, in addition to the regular stream, to that program. Now we've accepted 3 more. And they're, as I say, they're training in a very, very, very different way. And we've done some initial analysis. Those are the hip fracture data in terms of how many they have done, way more than their cohorts, way more than just about any intern that I know of in North America. These were number of cases as primary operator as an intern. They outperformed their cohorts on every single technical skill in the lab, and this is a reverse scale that shows that they have way more confidence in their own abilities even after a short year. So an N of 3 or an N of 6 doesn't a study make and doesn't a proof of principle prove, but nonetheless we're on the right track. We've had a gazillion external reviews. The biggest problem we've had is jealousy from the regular stream residents. So I would argue at this critical time in medical education, old ways won't work. And it's more than just about throwing some names at this. It's about really fundamentally changing the curriculum. In so doing for surgery, we need to ramp up procedural skills. We need to rigorously assess educational outcomes. And I think we need to promote the concept of team care. So thank you very much, Elaine, for inviting me and for the privilege of chatting with my colleagues.